You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here to the RSA this evening. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Bruce Hood. Bruce Hood is Professor of Developmental Psychology in Society at the University of Bristol. He's been a research fellow at Cambridge University and University College London, visiting scientist at MIT and faculty professor at Harvard, and has won a great many awards for his pioneering research throughout his career. He's the author of both specialist textbooks and popular works of psychology, and in 2011 delivered the prestigious Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, which were broadcast on the BBC to over 4 million viewers. Now, he's joining us today to destroy any illusions we may have, harbouring about the nature of the self, and to replace those with a much richer, more nuanced account of who. You will be changed over the next hour. You will not. If you want to leave now, that's up to you, but in an hour's time, you will be different. You will think about yourself in different ways. So, Bruce, we're delighted you're here today. You're talking about your book, The Self-Illusion. So, without further ado, join me in welcoming Bruce Hood.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think I should really call this the Marmite talk. Because, like Marmite, people either really like it or they really, really hate it. And I think the reason people feel passionate about it is because what I'm going to be talking about is something which is so personal to us, namely the experience of this thing that we call the self. Now, defining the self is in itself a very difficult problem because the language we use is problematic. The idea of there being an object and a subject of self, again, is logically difficult to conceive of. But what I really want to address today is what is the common, I think, perception of self. If you ask someone in the street about themselves, they will tell you a potted history and autobiography. They may tell you that they like certain things, or they might be able to describe their current phenomenological consciousness and experience in the present moment. And what I'm going to say is those accounts of this individual, this character, this integrated, coherent entity is illusory. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. People misconceive or misinterpret, I think, the term illusion. What illusion really means is it's not what it seems. And what I'm hoping to convince you of this at this lunchtime is that this sense of the self is something which is constructed by our brains. So I'll talk a little bit about illusions and why they can be so compelling and yet false. And then I'll talk about how the self really is, I think, constructed over childhood. So the first premise is that the external world is simulated by our brains. We have no direct contact with reality. We're continually processing the information through our senses, and we're storing this in our brain. And so we have representations of the external world, and then we have representations that we store, that we bring to bear when we're thinking about and trying to understand the world around us. But we have no direct contact. Everything is filtered through this wonderful biological computer, the brain. So what do I mean by an illusion? Well, this is a very famous one. It's simple, but it's very sophisticated, in my opinion. It's the Kanitsa illusion. Now, if you look at this, you have this overwhelming, hopefully, impression that there's a white square sitting above the four circles. But, of course, there is nothing there at all. Now, that's a visual illusion, and now that I've told you that, you still see the square, and that in itself is an interesting point, that when you have insight into an illusion, it doesn't necessarily eradicate it. But here's something which I think is really quite interesting. If I was to go into your brain, to the visual processing area at the back of your brain, I can find these specialized cells that we'll talk about in a moment called the neurons. Now, neurons, they respond, and I can find neurons which are responding to edges of squares. But the interesting thing, the same neuron which responds to an edge would also respond to this illusory edge. So what that means is that the brain interprets this arrangement and comes up with a solution, that this must be a white square above four circles. And then, if you like, sends down information lower into the system saying there's an edge there, so fire as if it's really there. So the hallucination is to all intents and purposes, real. And if you feel that you can really trust your consciousness, then, again, I think illusions dispel that notion because we can demonstrate very dramatically that your phenomenological experience is not what it seems. So this is another illusion. It's quite famous. You've probably seen it before. It's the visual auditory illusion called the McGurk effect. If you haven't, then prepare to be amazed. So I want you to watch carefully and tell me what you think this man is saying.
Ba, 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 ba.
Well, hands up if you've heard him say da-da, da-da, da-da. Great, and you probably would put money on that. Now, I'm going to play the same piece again, but close your eyes and listen carefully.
Ba, 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 ba.
Hands up if you heard Baba. Good, your hearing's perfect. He is actually saying Baba. Now, there is proof that your phenomenological experience cannot really be trusted. You have no direct contact with reality, okay? Your brain takes the auditory signal, which is Ba, and then we superimpose the visual signal of Ga. You have no representation of your brain for that sound and that vision, so your brain comes up with a solution, and that's constructed, okay? It's not real. Okay, so this is me. This really is me, actually. This is my brain from one of our studies. And everything I am, my fears, my anxieties, my humor, my everything, my memories, is somehow stored and computed in this three-pound lump of tissue. But obviously, this thing, Bruce, I didn't pop out of my mother's womb as Bruce. I had to become Bruce, didn't I? So I think there's something to be said about development. How does the brain eventually become what we recognize as the individuals? Well, one way to think about it is to draw a distinction that William James did between the experience of I, which is the conscious phenomenology of who I am in the present moment, with me, which is the autobiography, the history of who I am. And so I would think it's quite plausible that very young infants may have conscious awareness. Well, I'm sure they do, in fact. So I think they've got the I experience, but they don't necessarily have the me experience, which is the history. Now, of course, when you're having your I experience, you bring to bear upon this experience all the sort of histories that you've had. So I think they're separable components. So how do I and me become Bruce? Well, it must be something to do with the way that we store information and the networks which make up the kind of higher processing levels of the brain. These are the neurons. This is a diagram. And they're all connected up in this massive parallel system which are exchanging communication through these nerve impulses. And when the world imposes upon you, this sets up these chains of activation patterns, and these become stored. And it's these stored patterns or representations, is basically the language of the brain. And you've got a lot of them, about 86 billion of them. Now, what might surprise you is that very young babies also have about 86 billion neurons. But what they lack is all the connections between the neurons. And it's the connections between the neurons which provides the immense processing power of the brain. What actually happens over experience is these connections become strengthened. So here is a portion through the cortex. By the way, most of the neurons are in your outer cortex, this thin 3-millimeter layer. This is a very young baby, and here again it's six years. So you can see the number of cells is roughly the same, but what's changing is the connections between them. This is driven by two processes. The brain is given biological information to simply sprout out all these connections, but the environment works to strengthen those which are stimulated. So if they're firing together, they're wiring together. And another kind of turn of phrase neurobiologists say, if you don't use them, you lose them. So in this way, the brain is becoming sculpted through the experiences of the early environments. This explains a number of interesting phenomena. For example, we're very good at telling faces apart, though not often when it comes to someone like Robin Ince, who's this more famous comedian. I'm often mistaken for him. And indeed, I've actually autographed his books, much to the annoyance of his fans. But we can tell faces apart very readily, unless they're from a different race. If we haven't been exposed to another race, we find it quite hard. That's why we say they all look alike. We certainly find it harder to tell sort of monkey faces apart. But what might interest you is that if you take very young babies, they have no problem telling different race faces apart, or indeed they can tell the difference between monkeys quite easily. But with experience, they become tuned in to their environment. The environment is shaping the representations they have in their brain. So I've been talking about perception, but the talk today is really about the self. And so what we need to think about is what the brain does socially, because we're increasingly coming to understand that many of the sophisticated aspects of the brain are really all to do with something about getting on with each other. So we have a brain which we call a social brain, which enables us to live in these large groups. And over the past sort of 15 and 20 years, we've established there are areas which seem to recognize faces and body movements, so there's a perceptual recognition system. There are systems for thinking about what someone else might be imagining, what we call mentalizing, putting yourself in someone's position or, you know, taking their perspective. We have an emotional system. You know, we feel other people's emotions. We see them crying and we cry, or we hear them laughing and we feel the compulsion to laugh. And then recently there's been a mirroring system, kind of controversial, but I think it's true to say that we seem to be synchronized to other people's movements. And that synchrony is something which is very important for social interactions. And I think one of the most interesting aspects about the social brain is I believe it must be shaped through this early experience of social interactions. We're all born with this tendency to want to look after our young, to nurture them, because I don't think it's any coincidence, but humans have proportionally the longest period as infants in comparison to any other social animal. And it's not that we're just exchanging information or passing on knowledge from one generation to the next. I think this is a mechanism to make us become social. And if you raise them in isolation, we know from the work of Harry Harlow, this can have a detrimental effect. So it's not the fact they're not getting food or they're not being kept warm. Harlow demonstrated that if you raise them and nurture them, then rhesus monkeys will end up with profound problems of socialization. And the same thing happens with humans. So babies are born to be social from the start. We respond to them socially, and they respond back to us this way. They will cry. They have empathy. When they hear crying, they will cry themselves. They will seek to soothe and share. They will directly try to interact with adults to get a rise out of them. And they will often help total strangers without any training whatsoever. Now, for anyone who denies that babies are born to try and interact with humans, I've got this little bit of video clip off YouTube, so I hope I'm not violating any copyright. But I think this demonstrates very compellingly that babies are always seeking out others, paying attention to the adults, and then trying to get some response from them. So you're in the moment, you're going to see this is the adult, this is the father, who sneezes in the background. And I think these are two twin boys. But watch how they respond.
It's my boy. Bless you. Bless you, baby. Bless you.
So you can see the babies are deliberately trying to get a response from the adults. And in fact, that's what babies do. Anyone who works with young children and babies realizes that the focus of attention are not the toys, it's not the television, it's other humans. That's the most interesting thing to a baby. And of course, they grow into become toddlers. Now, I'm not suggesting that they just are pro-social or promiscuously social. They tend to be kind of they're focusing in on those individuals or those adults which are responding to them. Now, of course, as we develop over these early years, we're becoming individuals. We initially start off as being the focus of our parents' attention, but then we have to learn and change socially. We have to get on with siblings. We have to get on with peers. We're becoming part of the tribe. And this ability is subserved by various systems. So we can recognize who we are. This is a classic kind of Rouge test. You know, the babies around about 18 months start to recognize the image as a reflection of themselves. This is an ability which is shared with other social animals, including dolphins and elephants. They're having a sense of identity. When children start to draw a distinction, for example, one of the earliest ones they make is between boys and girls, they start to sort of classify themselves and categorize themselves. And when they hear the stereotypes of what boys and girls do, they typically think that these are enduring characteristics. They're developing what we call a theory of mind, which is this ability to imagine someone else's perspective, to be less egocentric. And this is really important, because if you want to kind of get on in a group and then manipulate others, you have to sort of understand or imagine what they may be thinking. But really what's important, and this is something I think has been underestimated, is the importance that we put on other people's opinions of ourselves. I think children are increasingly becoming self-conscious over the middle childhood period to the point of adolescence where they're obsessed by what other people think about them. It's less what the parents think. It's more what their colleagues or their peers, I should say, are thinking. So we're on this path to becoming adults, and we're mimicking, copying, integrating all the time. And then we're taking our lead from those around us. Initially, this may be our parents, but increasingly, as our social circles broaden, we have to take into consideration the other people in that group. Another component which is really important about becoming a member of a tribe is being able to regulate your own drives and intentions and goals. So you need to be able to sort of have what we call self-control. And anyone who's ever worked with toddlers knows that below 3 years of age, children can be incredibly impulsive and lacking in self-control. And this has been demonstrated with a number of experiments, but you're probably more familiar with this example from a TV ad campaign, which is to demonstrate that children find it very difficult to suppress the urge to eat candy or marshmallows in this case. This is the famous marshmallow test. And in this test, you basically tell the child, well, you know, you can have one marshmallow now, but if you wait, you can have more. And they simply measure how long the child can resist the temptation. Well, the children find this really quite difficult. So self-control is something that children have to learn. And remarkably, their ability for self-control predicts how they behave later as adults. For example, those who can delay gratification, as we say, turn out to be more socially competent. They're also much better at school. They perform better in school. They're less disruptive. And they're also emotionally more stable. In fact, their performance at 4 years predicts whether or not they become drug addicts later on in 20 years of time. So why is this important? Well, you know, if you think about the brain as a constellation of systems, and this is why I don't think there's any self as such, you have all these drives, all these motives, all these contexts, all these things trying to kind of take control, but they have to be regulated. If you're going to be socially responsible, you know you've got to control your aggression and all the other things, and that's what being antisocial is all about. And these are regulated by these sort of supervisory systems in the frontal parts of the brain, which, by the way, undergo major maturation around about 3 to 4 years of age. So you're regulating your behavior all the time. Now, who is this regulator? Is there somebody sitting in the frontal lobes which is controlling it? Is there a self operating this machine like some sort of captain of a ship? Well, no. And yet I think that's what many of us experience or think. We feel we're in control of our bodies. We see our bodies as a vessel. We can see it aging in the mirror when we pass every year and look at ourselves. But we still feel that we're an integrated, coherent, cohesive individual. And I would suggest that that is part of this illusion that the brain creates. Now, interestingly, if you ask people to meditate and think about themselves in the present moment in time and to try and imagine where they might be and then close their eyes, people sort of think they exist somewhere in their heads, behind their eyes. They don't think they exist in their buttocks or in their feet. They're in their head. And if you plot where people think they are, it tends to be behind the eyes. But there can't be a little self sitting in there in control of your body behind your eyes. Because if there were, then you just have the logical problem, who's inside their head, and their head, and their head, and so on. So advocating an individual does not solve your problem. Rather, I think this is probably a better way of thinking about the self. This is the numbskulls, for those who are old enough to remember this comic. And I'm not suggesting there's lots of little homunculi, but what I'm saying is that there are lots of slave systems, subsystems, which are working autonomously, and the output of those systems is somehow fed up and coordinated into the sense of the self. Now, we know this is true from the work of people like Gazzaniga and Roger Sperry, who were working with patients who, they basically had epilepsy, and so they... One of the ways to treat that is to separate the two halves of the brain by cutting through the corpus callosum. And now you have a brain which is effectively in two halves. So in one of their studies, they got the patients to fixate on the center of the screen and projected two different words, the word key into the left visual field and the word key into the right field. Now, due to the way that the pathways cross over, the word in the left field is processed in the right side of the brain, and the word in the right field is processed in the left. And when asked to say, well, what do you see? Because language is on the left side, they simply said ring. But when asked to pick up the object from the table with their left hand, which is controlled by the right side of the brain, they picked up the key. Now, the interesting thing is that when they were asked to try and explain their actions, what Gazzaniga found was that people would confabulate an account to make sense of it. They made up a story to make sense of this inconsistent information. We do this all the time. Here's a simple study. You can ask people which is the most attractive woman in this task, and then you point to one of them, and the experimenter can actually switch them over and give you the opposite card so you don't realize they've been surreptitiously switched. And when that happens, people tend to come up with an explanation of why they've chose that person. So they seem unaware that they've just actually had their choice switched. We have this compulsion to try and make sense of the inconsistencies. And I think this inconsistency explains cognitive dissonance. We have a story about who we are. We have this idea that we're a good person, or we've got a sense of humor, or we have some moral standing. And when we're confronted with circumstances which seem to conflate with that or conflict with that, we'll reinterpret the circumstances to fit to maintain this consistency. I think it also explains some of the classic examples in social psychology where people behave in ways which seem out of character of having a self. There's Ash's conformity studies. Basically, if 11 people say black is white, you're likely to agree with them. There's the work of Milgram, I'm sure you're aware of this, that most people think they wouldn't ever hurt or harm somebody to a great degree, but if the circumstances are right, people can find themselves indeed doing that. Again, this notion of the autonomous self is under question. And then there's Zimbardo's work showing that if you just arbitrarily separate people into in-groups and out-groups, they behave badly against them. And of course, these experiments have real-world applications in many examples where people just do things which just seem so uncharacteristic. So I'm just going to end up by now just by talking about the future. What's going to happen to the self with the new technologies? Because we're at a time in our evolution where we now have the capacity to extend ourself, to communicate ourself to a vast audience, never before in a two-way interaction. We think we're individuals on the web, but if you look at our behavior, this is an example, is a plot of Twitter communication, people segregate into these groups. Even though they feel they're individuals, they basically are forming around collective ideas. Here's probably a more profound example of the self. This is from the world of, if you don't know about it, there's a community called Second Life, which is a virtual community where you can create an avatar of your idealized notion of who you are. And this is a true story about David Pollard and Amy Taylor, who met in Second Life. And David Pollard had his avatar called Dave Barmy, who was a kind of a nightclub owner. He liked Italian suits, quite a sharp dresser. Amy created her idealized notion of herself called Laura Skye. She was more into the country and western look. And these two characters met in this virtual community, exchanged emails, and discovered that they actually had shared interests. So they decided to meet up in real life. But sometimes real life is not the same as the idealized notion. This is a real David Pollard and Amy Taylor. Now, they actually moved in together and got married, and that would have been a nice, happy ending to the story, except for one day when Amy came back to find that David Pollard was on virtual in Second Life again, having a virtual affair with another avatar. Whereupon Amy sued for divorce and won. And that's an interesting example of life reflecting art, reflecting life. I just want to end by saying that when you ask people at the end of their lives, what is your last regret, or what do you regret the most? This is the analysis of from Bronnie Ware's work. The one thing that people say is that they don't feel they ever lived a true self. So whilst we might deny the existence of self, I think we have this constant notion that we're being pulled by all the circumstances in our life, and we feel that we don't actually have the autonomous control. And I think we need to think about that autonomous control. I'm not suggesting that we're blank slates. Clearly we inherit something from our parents. People have different personalities. Anyone who's raised children knows that if you treat them the same, they still end up as individuals. But it's that individuality within the social environment which I think shapes us. And if you take away all that contextual information, then I would argue that you could effectively lose your identity of who you are. So thank you very much for the talk.
Thanks, Chris. That was fantastic. I'm just going to ask a couple of questions. By the way, I'm slightly worried. I have a 9-month-old daughter, and she was went out recently. There were two babies crying, and her reaction was to laugh. So she may be a psychopath. Anyway, you talked about one illusion at the beginning of your talk, and that was the square, because there isn't really there isn't really a square. But some people would argue that your kind of account suffers from a kind of reductive illusion, which is to say, for example, that, you know, what is ice cream? Ice cream is merely cream and sugar, and it goes through a process and it's frozen. But there is something called ice cream which is more than just cream and sugar and something that is frozen. It does some work, this concept of ice cream. We know what it means. It exists. And if I said, you shouldn't talk about ice cream because it doesn't really exist, it's just these three components or whatever, people would say, well, no, it does exist. It exists in my life. It has meaning.
Yeah.
So aren't you guilty of a kind of reverse illusion, which is the illusion of failing to recognize the emergent quality of self?
Yeah, and a similar argument was raised by Plato talking about the essential form. So he would say that the old chairs have a quality of form, of being a chair. You could say the thing about any constructed item, and I don't have a problem with that. But if you think that that property is invariant and totally independent of its constituent components, that's the problem. And I think that's what most people feel their self is. I mean, they feel they're over and beyond their material composition. So I'm not denying the functionality of talking about the self, and we interact as selves. And even if I deconstruct it, it wouldn't make any sense to try and have a conversation, thinking about you as not as an individual, but a collection of all the influences. That just doesn't make any sense. So from a kind of practical functional point of view, adopting the perspective of the reality of self is fine. My issue is just that if you then take that assumption further as being independent of all the constituent components. And I think that's really important, because if you think about it, our legal systems are premised on the notion of individuals. Mm. And yet that becomes increasingly problematic when you think about all the influences which are shaping people. Now, you might say, oh, well, that doesn't really take into consideration. That doesn't really count. Maybe they just had a bad childhood. Well, we're not interested in that. But what happens if they suddenly develop a tumor? Or what happens if they suddenly develop something, an integral component, composite part, which changes their behavior? Then that notion of the self, independent of those components, looks increasingly shaky. So I think that we just need to be, aware there's a difference between kind of the functionality of talking about selves and actually what it is in terms of the output of a multitude of systems.
But if you take that then, so if I was to work incredibly hard, and of course, as you said, it's not actually possible to do it, even though we know the illusion exists. But if I was to work incredibly hard so that I said, instead of saying I've made a decision, I would say a decision was, you know, a decision happened to me, as it were.
Yeah.
I was subject of a decision that was made by my brain. What good would that do me to think in those terms, to understand in those terms? And similarly, to apply that to other people, to say, well, this person is not guilty of a bad act. A bad act happened to them, as it were. They merely carried out a bad act, which was the consequence of all the causal factors impinging on them at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should adopt this kind of stance and therefore dismiss all crimes or whatever. I think having the sense of the self, it makes perfect logical sense. Because if you were to adopt the other position, you might never blame anybody. You might never try and induce any penal systems. But blame and guilt and punishments and imprisonments are all factors which play into the equation about whether people, you know, behave or not. So I'm not suggesting that no one is culpable anymore if you adopt this kind of perspective that I've taken. So I think it's still useful, though. Certainly I feel a little bit less preoccupied with my own weaknesses than I used to. I mean, people can get really quite obsessed by self-esteem, for example. If you think about the way we behave, you know, the way that we become preoccupied, it makes people do very strange things if they think about their value in terms of what other people think of them. And I think that that's something to be wary of. Certainly in other cultures, they don't have such an individualistic notion of the self. They have a more collectivist one. And so that does change the way that they interact in many ways. So I think it's a helpful, in my opinion, way of redressing the imbalance that I think exists currently, which is this idea that everyone is an individual and totally independent, because we're not.
But at one level, as your book argues, in a sense, there is something kind of perverse about this trick that we play on ourselves. And we use phrases, very odd phrases, like I said to myself, it's a fantastic, who is this conversation between? But why have we evolved to play this trick on ourselves? What is the evolutionary advantage of this illusion?
Well, just in the same way as the brain constructs the visual illusions or the auditory illusions or constructs perception, it's a very convenient way of abstracting the important information and producing an output which allows us to interact. We couldn't interact in a parallel system. We have to create this sort of individuals talking to individuals, and that enables or facilitates this interaction. And so I think it's a very useful way of actually just summarizing the multitude of influences which are actually playing into our decision processes and who we are.
But this capacity to think about thinking, which we uniquely have, no other species has it.
Well, we don't know that.
Well, as far as we can tell, no other species has the capacity to think about thinking. Other species have the capacity to think, but not to think about thinking.
Mm.
So it must therefore, I mean, the story of why it evolved in us and only us, and it evolved to such a degree in us and only us, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a puzzle. It must do some pretty powerful work for us. And I guess you'd say, well, that is reflected in the fact that, you know, in culture and human progress and all those things. Do you think we yet understand fully the very beginnings of this, why it evolved at the very, very first place?
No, and I'd be speculating to say so. I mean, I think that what makes us very different, there are other social animals, and there are animals who have varying degrees. You know, for example, I was saying some of the hallmarks on the emergence of self are things like self-recognition and imitation, theory of mind. There's evidence that these all exist in a number of other social animals to varying degrees, but nothing to the extent that exists in humans. Now, that might just be because this is our niche, and therefore why would you expect them to have these sorts of abilities? Nevertheless, I think that it's our capacity for communication, our capacity for social integration, and this extended childhood that we have all seem to be candidates, in my opinion, as the factors which would require the evolution of a self-identity that is shaped by those around us. So I suppose, in answer, if I was to speculate, I think it's a consequence of us becoming this kind of super social species that needs the self.
This notion of the kind of collective consciousness that one of the intriguing implications, it seems to me, of the kind of insights in your book is that if we are all responding all the time automatically, then therefore we are not separate. In no way are we separate, because the notion of selfhood is a separating notion, that there is a boundary around me. There's this thing called the self and a boundary around me, which is analogous to the kind of physical boundary. But actually, the way that our brains work is not like that at all. They are a node in the world, and particularly they're a node in a world of social interaction. So I'm interested, what do you think there's something there which could lead to a shift, as it were, in political values and other things, from a recognition that we are intrinsically, our consciousness is intrinsically a collective phenomenon?
Well, I wouldn't advocate that there's a collective consciousness in the sense that in any kind of paranormal ability. But I would agree that, for example, you take the case of morality. Morality is a property of a group. You can have whether or not it's right to hurt an individual. But generally, our moral values are basically the output of the way that we interact with each other. So they're kind of passed on. And, of course, they evolve and change. There's nothing cast in stone. But we acquire many of those aspects. I mean, there is work showing that babies do have moral foundations, so they know the difference between good and right. But that becomes shaped by what we think is culturally correct. So in that sense, that framework is definitely extended out there in the sea of brains, which are all part of the same group. So, yeah, I believe that, I mean, that notion of a collective kind of representation of how to behave or how your tribe behaves is something that is not within any individual. It's actually an emergent property of all the group.
Great. Okay, let me... Oh, my word. So we'll take two lots of three to kick us going. So we'll start with you two in the front.
Mark Thompson. Thank you, Bruce, for the talk. Very interesting. I've been reading a lot about brain lateralization and the difference between the right and the left brain and experiments that are done with brain-altering drugs to put people in left or right brain states. And from what I've read, the sense of self is contained within the left brain rather than the right brain, and that the right brain is a brain that contains the concept of we or community. Is that something you've come across? And if so, what
of course, there's that amazing the woman who had the stroke, and therefore
a YouTube video on that.
Yeah, I can't remember her name, but someone's going to shout out her name in a second. But have you seen that video?
No, I have. No.
Jill Balty Taylor.
Oh, sure. Yes, of course. Yeah, the neuroscientist.
And has this amazing kind of transcendent feeling because...
Yeah, that's a famous TED talk, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right, I did see that one. Well, I'm not sure about the evidence for the experience of we. It does sound, I mean, this idea of the left side is consistent with the notion that if you think about a lot of our phenomenology is language-based. And of course, language is on the left-hand side, and the Gazzaniga work shows that, if they have to describe everything, they tend to pick up the information which is processed by the language centers of the brain. I think the lateralization situation is probably overstated. There's a lot of parallel activity in the brain, although I was kind of talking about different slave systems. In reality, they're all fairly much connected up together. As to the effects of various drugs, who knows? They generally shut down all the inhibitory systems, which allow everything to kind of go a little bit looser. But I don't think I have any specific evidence, or I don't know of any evidence, which suggests that a self versus others are literally lateralized in the brain as such.
There was supposed to be some studies done on chimpanzees showing the difference between bonobo chimps and normalized chimpanzees.
Yeah.
So the bonobos seemed to be operating from a right-sided perspective, which was more of a kind of a weak community-based perspective, whereas other chimpanzees in Africa were operating more from a left-brain perspective. It was...
Well, I don't know if that's a description, because they definitely do behave socially, very different animals, different species. That's a description which alludes to the right side. I simply don't... I'd be cautious of drawing those direct causal associations and links.
Hi. James Burrell. I'm a trustee of San Patriano UK, which is, broadly speaking, a charity based in Italy for rehabilitation of drug users, particularly heroin users. And I was interested that you said that for age four you can identify potential drug users by their lack of self-control. Surely this means that there's a very simple solution to this. Just we can solve all the drug addiction problems by educating people in self-control at that age.
Well, there's actually studies underway at the moment in Canada and America where they're introducing programs to allow children to... Because actually the way that children operationalize self-control is they distract themselves. Mm. So if you teach them a whole bunch of distracting techniques, you will have noticed in the video they're not looking at the focus. Children who are capable of employing techniques which take their focus attention elsewhere are able to show delayed gratification. And actually, there's a body of work called ego depletion showing that the more you try to avoid a very tempting thing, or the more you try to control your behavior, there can be a rebound effect. So if you've ever been in a situation where you kind of try to control your temper. As soon as you're out of that situation, you feel like a stiff drink or eat lots of cookies or ice cream, whatever.
Okay,
so there's a reservoir, if you like, of self-control or willpower that can be depleted temporarily. Back to the basic point, I think that absolutely, I think education is great anyway, and I think that anything which helps children control their emotional outbursts is really, really important, because I think we've not fully appreciated the importance of motivations and emotions and the role they play in social integration at a very young age.
I mean, the very simple conclusion of what you were saying was that if you can teach people self-control, they can achieve so much more.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's always going to be the problem of context. And, you know, I'm not so naive to say that simply teaching a four-year-old how to avoid eating a marshmallow will protect them from the effects of heroin at 20, or actually, it turns out it was cocaine addicts. And again, there are different types of drugs which produce different types of profiles. So I wouldn't want to kind of put them all in one bag, but there's something to be said for that.
I'd just add to that. I was at a talk last night at LSE from Salman Khan, who developed the Khan Academy, which is a quite incredible innovation which is going to change the world. It has already changed the world, but is going to change the world. And his work shows that in classes where typically teachers say only 20% of pupils are self-motivated, actually the teaching methodologies he has changes that dramatically. And it turns out that quite a big reason for this is that this is about youngsters who feel that they can't achieve. And who don't want to ask for help and feel humiliated by their inability to solve a problem.
Right.
If they're given the ability to solve the problem in their own way and in their own time, they change. So this categorization of those who do have self-control and those who don't is subject to a lot, you know, can change very quickly depending on kind of context. Okay.
Two-part question. First, very quickly, about the magicians, the performers who control themselves in every kind of way. Have they done this because they've studied all these different aspects of the brain that you've described? That's the first one. I mean, obviously, they've learned self-control in a major way. Second point, how's it helped you in your life to know all these things?
My experience of magicians and actors to that extent is that they're generally intuitively good at these things because all the years of... I mean, if you go to a good tutor, I could explain, for example, misdirection, how a magician could get you to look in one direction by the power of social control. And I could give you the brain mechanisms of how that works. But actually, that's not really that relevant to a magician. He simply just needs to know what you do. And those who are very good at controlling, those people who seem to be very good actors, for example, they have almost an intuitive sense where it just feels naturally right, whereas others are much more self-conscious about it.
You don't have to comment on the authenticity of David Blaine.
No, thank you.
But there are people who can hold their,
The people who can meditate. And, yeah, absolutely. There are people who can regulate their body's defense, can withhold pain and walk across. Well, actually, the walk across coals one is really dead easy anyway. But there are other examples where...
don't try it at home.
It's not that difficult to do. But so
imagine the emails. I went home, walked across coals. According to your speaker, it was very easy, and now I'm in terrible pain. Anyway.
Well, the point is not to stand. It's just to walk very quickly. Having this insight doesn't necessarily change how you behave. I mean, when I self-reflect, I mean, very often I'm on autopilot, like most of us. And when we're making decisions, we can plan for the future, by the way. I'm not suggesting there's no ability to do that. But very often when we're at the end of the day thinking back over the contents of the day or we come out of a situation, we're often reconstructing it and focusing on some things or others which fit with this notion. To me, I mean, I think I do believe that I have changed in my concern about others, what others think about me. But still, you know, many of these things are automatic and unconscious, and therefore, you know, I can still respond. And that doesn't really help me, you know, plan for the future.
Your last slide suggested that if you strip away your work, your hobbies, and everything around, which is pretty much what you do, then what is left is that what you are, but how would you define what you are then?
Well, the point about that last slide is to draw you back to the original illusion, which is that it's an emergent property of the context you're in. And I thought about that slide in the context of dementia, senile dementias, because one of the most distressing things for people who have relatives who have dementia is this deconstruction of their identity. They seem to become someone else. So what I was hoping to capture in that slide is the multifaceted nature of existence and the way that we fail to often recognize the extent to which we are a reflection of the groups that we inhabit and the activities that we do. And so that self, in that particular context, seems to disappear. I wouldn't say that's really, really true. I'm just trying to emphasize the extent to which context is very important in shaping who we become.
And I think that's just something I feel very passionate about. But the notion of there's 400,000 people in residential homes in England, and that's 400,000 people who we've said because they don't function at one level of what it is to be a person, we just need to drive them out of society entirely. And
put
You know, which is a very, you know, there will come a time when this will seem like a medieval.
We are lonelier now than we've ever been. Yeah. I mean, we're creating this generation of people. There's more communication, there's more people, but paradoxically, I think we're becoming more lonely.
There's a Twitter question.
Yes, thanks everyone for tweeting. This question was, so Rowan Williams asked Richard Dawkins if consciousness
I thought for one moment there was Rowan Williams tweeting.
If Rowan Williams asked Richard Dawkins if consciousness is an illusion, what isn't? How would you answer the same question with reference to the self?
A consciousness question. I would say that consciousness is not what it seems, but that doesn't deny the existence of phenomenology that we could all talk about, that we recognize as being a state of awareness. To me, consciousness is the output of the system. And you might say, well, that's not really answering the question. Well, it is to some extent. So the output of the system is what it does. I mean, there is no one having the consciousness, because then you have to evoke an individual. And that, I think, is the paradox of that kind of framing the question. To many philosophers, that's not even a question. But I would also just add that even the consciousness, and hopefully with some of the demonstrations, what you think you're experiencing is not what's really going on. So that, I hope, kind of suggests it falls into the same realm of this constructed phenomenology. Now, if you're talking about the hard question, which is, well, how can you have that mental state arise from a material system? Well, we simply don't have an answer to that. And again, there are some who think it's an illogically posed question. But yeah, it's illusory in the same way.
I saw once, I can't remember the name of the book, someone else will help me on this one, but a wonderful metaphor for this, which is the idea that we should see the relationship between the brain and the world as somewhat parallel to, if you're standing in a room and there's a mirror on both sides of you, and these mirrors then are mirrors to each other, and the thing goes on forever.
Yeah.
And the
Douglas Hofstadter.
That's right. And he'd done this thing where he'd shown that if you use two cameras rather than two mirrors, and you have an object in the middle, and the cameras, as it were, film each other, what happens is totally unpredictable. You can't ever know what's going to happen because of the level of complexity and the speed of what's happening there.
Right.
And that, in a sense, was... So all that is happening is an object and two cameras, but yet that which emerges from it has an emergent quality which cannot simply be explained in terms of the two cameras and the object. Do you think that's a useful way of thinking about it?
I think it is. I mean, the notion of emergent properties is not just useful, it's true. Mm. There are many phenomena in nature where you really simply cannot talk about them as existing independently of the systems, and often you can't predict how they're going to arise. But I suppose the consciousness question really is this idea about this mental state arising from a material stuff. I mean, this is something that Descartes thought about with dualism, and it continues to obsess people today. And of course, the new technologies. I mean, are we ever going to build a conscious robot? Well, according to my materialist position, well, yes. It may not be a consciousness the same as a human consciousness, but it's the output of the system. In effect, it's robot consciousness.
Great. Yeah.
I'm interested in your thoughts about the link to Buddhism. I mean, my limited understanding of Buddhist thought is that the understanding of no separate self is pointing to exactly the same thing. And where that seems to go in Buddhism is that given that we're not separate, given that I understand that you exist in the way you do because of lots of factors that have led there, that it's easier to feel compassion and, you know, and generate wisdom. And I just wondered about the thought about how you get that into the public debate, given, for example, the stuff in the health service recently where people want to blame individuals, but it's so obvious that Milgram and Ash and so on, that it's the effect of the environment that makes any of us more or less compassionate. And just how to get people to understand that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I get a lot of flack from true, you know, scholars in Buddhism, so I have to be very wary about what I'm saying. But yes, I think the general principle that the self is an emergent out of context is fine. But to your more general point about how we should live our lives, what are the political implications about this, what are the moral implications about this, I think this is really, really important. It's very easy to point the finger and talk about an individual, and in many ways it's very convenient to do so. And also, as Matthew pointed out earlier on, I mean, you're not going to just get rid of the individual, get rid of penal systems. By the way, they don't seem to be working, our penal systems, so that's another point. They don't work because they're they're misconceived about what the self is. I mean, the reason that people are in these situations is because of the catalogue of the history, also in conjunction with some of the biology that they bring to bear upon it, has put them in this place. So
Do you think, by the way, that, I mean, it's still contested, but there seems to be a really quite powerful evidence now of the effect of lead on behaviour. Do you think this wasn't spotted for so long simply because we don't want to accept explanations like that? We're so embedded in the notions of personal morality as being the cause of wrongdoing.
Yeah, it is. It's a very interesting... You know, people dip in and out of their medical models or medical worldviews or biological models when it's convenient. And when I think it's something that's just attacking their intelligence... Or something like that, they tend not to like that idea because it seems as if it gets to the self-illusion that they're constructed. Mm. But they're happy for other conditions, which are not to do with the mind, to be medically... So we're very happy to have kind of tumors on the body and that. But the notion that our mind is effective similarly is... And there's no reason why you should draw the distinction because it's all just cells. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think people will quite happily switch between... The kind of materialist model and the more kind of non-materialist view of the world, depending on what you're talking about.
The idea that one's personality is located inside one's head is quite modern, is it not? I mean, before that, people thought what their personalities were located in their hearts, didn't they? What happened?
And different cultures have different views. I think the liver in Far Eastern cultures. The experience, though, I would imagine most of you, I hope, feel that you're kind of looking out through your eyes and this is your phenomenology of it. But, yeah, there are cultural variations about where the locus is. The heart, for example, in Egyptian... I'm not an expert on this area, but there were different locuses of where they felt the engine was. But the phenomenology of consciousness, I think most people would agree it's in your head.
You've talked about... the mental construct, which is my sense of self, at one moment. But, of course, this exists over time. Mm. And I can remember being that self way back, and even further back than that. And that seems to be to rest on the notion of memory. And this is John Locke's idea.
Yes.
Is that the modern idea? Is memory fundamental to that, or is there more to it?
There is more to it. I got, and in case you're watching, or I got a lot of flack from a particular specialist in this area who pointed out that actually amnesics who have lost their episodic memories, autobiographical memories, still have a sense of self. What I would say is I still think Locke is right. You may not know the individual details of the stories which have formed your life story, but you still have a sense of the character that you are. And so whilst you may not be able to articulate exactly what the details of your past have been, you can still have a sense of identity, which is continuous. In truth, of course, we know that memories, and that would have been part of my talk, but I only had 20 minutes, our memory is notoriously fallible, and we tend to have a confirmation bias, and we reframe everything, which maintains this cohesion and consistency. And I think that's what the brain's always trying to do. It's a storyteller. That's at the perceptual sensory level all the way up to the social brain. We are telling stories. We're building models which bring together the relevant information in a concise, convenient, user-friendly format that we can then build upon to do.
But just to clarify, what you're not saying is that memory is this meanness, this continuous self, because what you're saying is that memory is the thing which contributes to that notion. So, in a sense, memory is like an enormously elaborate photograph album, which is full of stories.
Right.
And when we decide, when... A decision happens to us to do something, it is constructed in the context of all those individual snapshots of the past. But there isn't really a continuous me running through that.
Okay, so there are a couple of points there. Just to clarify, psychologists immediately dismiss the notion of memories being like photographs because they're always dynamic. And actually, the information that you extract from the situation is always is only partial. And even when the memory is inside your hippocampus or your memory systems, it's constantly being retold and shaped by new information coming in. So, for example, false memories, classically, you just need to simply introduce an idea and people will incorporate that into their original memory. And they can't tell the difference between what's false and what's original. So memories are continually dynamic. But yes, it's getting back to this idea, is that the memory is if you like, are the data points, which are sampled, and then they're brought together to form this consistency of character. And that's what I think that the brain does.
And then finally?
Very quick point. As a devoted Wittgensteinian, I feel I've been listening to Plato for the last half an hour. To what extent is the self an illusion only if and only if the word self is assumed to be a nominative? The word self has so many different uses in our embedded in our language. You've just picked on one.
True. Yeah, and again, this is a point before the talk I was saying we could have an hour about describing what you mean by the self. Because you can't be the hunter and the hunted at the same time. We get our language of describing, discussing phenomena is bedeviled by the notion of there being an independent, objective self, which exists independently of the subjective. So I agree. I've taken a very restricted view on the self, hopefully one which most people recognize, has a familiarity. And in many ways, I've chosen an easy target. Certainly philosophers would think that's an easy target. But it may be an easy target, but it's one that we all too often and too easily forget. And hopefully, you know, this book does remind people just to kind of reconsider the kind of composite nature of identity. So, yeah, I'm guilty as charged on that. But I didn't want to give an hour on definition of what the self is.
Okay, well, thank you all for what's been a fantastic... Only at the RSA would people start preface a question with, as a committed Wittgensteinian, which is fantastic. So thank you all for coming and for asking great questions. The assemblage of flesh, blood and neurons, which is Bruce Hood, will sign the book, but it's not him who's signing the book, you understand that. It's just a set of processes. A set of processes taking place in a particular context, but he is available, nevertheless. To sign his wonderful book, Self Illusion, which is a fantastic read. But can I ask you to join me in thanking Bruce Hood?
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.